I want to thank all of you for coming to the presentation today about the nature of ecumenism, both in the present and the kinds of challenges that we face in the world today. I want to thank especially Dr. Tom Ferguson for his presentation and collegiality. Tom and I have known each other for 5 years through this work, and already we have seen many changes to the nature of ecumenical and interreligious endeavors, some of which I will outline today as I discuss the challenges that face many Christians and those of other religions in the world today. My hope is to be relatively brief around current challenges so that we have the opportunity for conversation together following our presentations. Denominational unity in the 19th century reflected large immigrant populations in the United States attempting to situate their structures along the lines of ethnic or national identification. For instance, Lutherans in the United States could at one time claim 156 budding denominational bodies. Today, in the 21st century, there are 5 major denominations in the United States. So, in many denominations, early identification along ethnic lines gave way to larger unities in the great melting pot experiment here in this country. Other ethnic, or rather racial, lines of demarcation were not so easily overcome. Until recently, for instance, there has been no significant national bilateral dialogue between historic black churches and historic white churches in this country. For historic black churches such as the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church or the African Methodist Episcopal Church, up through the civil rights movement, race has been a major factor in denominational identity. Many of these identities were, early on in the 19th century, shaped by white racial identity and bias, rather than seeking unity in the body of Christ. Today, this major challenge still faces us as we together attempt to nurture greater unity between these historic denominations. Even as numbers of members in these denominations continue to shrink in what is often described as a post-denominational context, current ecumenical conversation on a post-denominational climate for Christian unity seems all the rage today. By post-denominational, I mean how we understand being a Christian community in the world, even as denominations lose their historical privilege. What is identified as an emerging post-denominational model for being church reflects larger social changes and consequences. Distrust of large hegemonic and centrally controlled organizations gives way to local and regional grassroots efforts and cooperative work in Christian identity. Simultaneously, major changes in the nature of world Christianity means that some emerging churches in other parts of the world are sending missionaries to the United States. There are Christian affiliations in the continent of Africa, for instance, that are sending missionaries to the United States. Many of these missionaries are serving specific ethnic and national communities, which reflect a growing reversal to the unifying post-ethnic specific trends among Christians, which Dr. Ferguson identified as taking place in the 19th century. Conciliar bodies, such as the World Council of Churches, the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, the Lutheran World Federation, and the National Council of Churches in the United States, are likewise facing their own internal and external challenges. After World War II, these conciliar bodies began in earnest for a variety of very good reasons, not the least of which was to ensure that the atrocities of genocides in the 20th century would not again take place unchecked by organized constellations of Christian response. This conciliar effort was indeed influential. For instance, the Dutch Reformed Church, or the DRC, in South Africa had offered theological and biblical rationales for the system of apartheid. Member communions of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, or WARC, responded by leveling heavy criticism against the DRC. This and other measures by WARC undermined the insidious rationales for apartheid and furthermore encouraged other member conciliar bodies to divest from companies operating within the South African government. The effort at addressing systemic oppression by countering errant theologies was a success story for confronting and turning around a theological anathema in the life of a national church. The conciliar effort faced this challenge and similar challenge from the 1950s to the present. The rise of what we often refer to as global Pentecostalism is also an emerging reality and challenge for the experience of being Christian today, largely in post-colonial areas of the world, stretching from the continents of Africa to Latin America. The so-called Pentecostal movement in recent years is the largest single growth in adherence to Christianity in the world. Along with the global expressions of Orthodoxy and the Roman Catholic Church, Pentecostalism is emerging as a prime ecumenical force in Christian relations. When one considers that the World Council of Churches is comprised of 360 communion members, and that statistics reveal there are likely 33,000 different denominational affiliations in the world, even if these latter numbers are somewhat exaggerated, the challenges of who speaks for the voice of Christian identity in the world would appear a significant challenge in the face of rising Pentecostalism. Now, this is not to cast aspersions on so-called Pentecostalism, and I should say a number of these emerging denominations would not refer to themselves necessarily as Pentecostal. But we need to have some way of identifying this phenomena, and this seems to be a word that seems more agreeable by consensus to many of these Christian groups that are arising today. Many of those in conciliar bodies are not asleep at the switch and are reaching out to Pentecostals and evangelicals in the world through new emerging conciliar bodies, such as the Global Christian Forum, or, in this country, Christian Churches Together in Christ. Both GCF and CCT are a representation of ecclesial families, from Orthodox and Protestant to historic ethnic and evangelical. Decision-making, rather than hierarchical and mandatorial, is largely democratic through the means of reaching consensus around issues that range from fighting poverty to the reality of an emerging interreligious world. In some ways, then, emerging conciliar bodies are attempting to respond to a growing diversity of Christianity in the world today. Part of this emerging reality is consciousness of religious diversity external to Christianity. The phrase emerging interreligious world is certainly a misnomer. The multiplicity of religions are not merging, or emerging, I should say, but rather our consciousness of them in the world is emerging. My point is simply that religions in the world are becoming more aware, more often, of one another. And this happens, for example, with reference to Christian-Muslim relations. I should say this awareness did not happen overnight, as we sometimes believe in this country after the horror of 9/11. It is true, however, that in recent years, local grassroots models had an impact methodologically on developing local and state interfaith commissions around the United States. Emphasis has been placed on Christian, Muslim, Jewish, or Abrahamic relations in terms of much of the interreligious activity in this country, but not exclusively on the Abrahamic. In the United States, interreligious cooperation in Kansas City, Los Angeles, Boston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., to name a few. And I should say that, coincidentally, the oldest mosque in the United States is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Where we see local contexts between religions that have gained significant traction, as in the cities I've mentioned, we can see a growing interreligious presence. Organizations such as the World Conference of Religions for Peace and its national affiliates, or the Parliament of World Religions, which has its international headquarters in Chicago, are seeking unity of voice and policy on social and commensurate issues, from a stand on torture to combating hunger and HIV/AIDS. The challenges to Christian unity are what take place when religions are brought within such hailing distance of one another, how we coexist respectfully and beyond mere tolerance, with sometimes competing or significantly unique truth claims, are central to this new emerging reality. The question for Christians is not only about salvation, but whether and how much God's revelation is operative in other religions. Conciliar studies from the National and World Council of Churches reveal that Christians by and large desire to accept that God's revelation is present in other religions. Furthermore, larger historical efforts at comparing and contrasting different religious truth claims have been central to these efforts. But challenges remain. How will these religions address together what it means to coexist with one another in a globalizing and pluralistic world? Part of the current challenge for Christians is a recognition that new models for engaging in interreligious dialogue cannot be taken wholesale from those models constructed in ecumenical, or I should say intra-Christian dialogue, in the past 100 years. Thus, new vehicles for interreligious mediation must continue to be refined, and they are taking place on both local, state, regional, national, and international levels. Time is of the essence in a radically changing world, so these new models must be developed on the fly, so to speak, and many of these models are developed in places of conflict around the world. One topic of shared concern between religions is the nature of internal fundamentalism. A rise in fundamentalism can be documented in every major religion in the world in recent years, often paired with a 21st century version of ethno-religious nationalism. This reality will remain as a central challenge in years to come. Religions must draw from the core of their claims to meaning and truth through their sacred scriptures in order to disavow any easy justifications for God's sanctification of violence against fellow human beings or the world. Major leaders, from King Abdullah II of Jordan to His Holiness Benedict XVI, take this challenge very seriously. There are other challenges to the ecumenical movement, such as how to reach the next generation of young adults who see religion through a very different optic today. I met a young woman, for instance, 2 weeks ago, who claimed she was a Buddha Utheran. She practiced Buddhism during her studies in college and then returned each summer to central Minnesota to attend church at her home Lutheran congregation. Young adults define themselves today not by singularities of denominational affiliation, by and large, but in terms of relationships sometimes to multiple religions. This way of being Christian will be a challenge to Christian communions and to the ecumenical movement today. The current global crisis, as you might imagine, also presses Christian denominations in the United States, Canada, and abroad to realign their fundamental goals of mission and ministry, both domestically and globally. The financial challenges are paired with challenges of the question of representation in this country. What I mean to say is that where one's numbers begin to fall in denominational affiliation, the question arises of whether leaders in these denominations represent a constituency or a particular piety. This is no truer than where denominations have advocacy platforms in places like Washington, D.C. or New York in their work through the United Nations. Emergent realities, such as President Obama's new convening in the coming weeks of an interfaith task force in the United States, are certainly positive and give Christian communions and interreligious friends a platform for working together on significant public policy-related issues. Still, the questions of financial solvency and public representation remain important ones at this time in our shared history. At core to this challenge of representation will remain one of the fundamental challenges up to the mid-21st century. There is little doubt that denominations will remain in numerous forms, ecclesial structures and full communion relationships, such as those between the Episcopal Church and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, may well become more integrated quicker than one imagined in the face of these recent challenges. Christian leaders will undoubtedly become more imaginative and proficient in their cooperative work together. And yet, even here, there is one further fundamental issue I want to address that is presenting itself as a significant challenge, and perhaps the last largest challenge of the effects of the Reformation itself, that is now taking center stage in ecumenical discourse. This challenge is often referred to as the principal challenge of human sexuality. As you might imagine, the quest for Christian unity does not easily subscribe to the 1980s popular adage, "I'm okay, you're okay." Although I imagine like me, sometimes I wish it were that simple. Central to the challenge of understanding sexuality for Christians worldwide is when it is paired with the ministry of oversight. In short, can one be a minister of word and sacrament and simultaneously be in a committed same-gendered relationship? The answer to this question is not merely an issue of social bias or of the church perhaps falling behind the times due to outmoded or restricted means of viewing the institution of marriage. Rather, central to this question of sexuality is the long Christian heritage, which dates back deep into our Judeo-Christian roots, of the nature of theological anthropology. Theological anthropology is about what the human being is as both broken and redeemable, how the human subject stands in relation to the divine, and what kinds of relationships are permitted for the human and the divine order of human social interaction. I want to say here I'm not vying for any particular aspect of this. I just simply want to identify the facts so that the arguments are clear. Even the quintessential Christian claims of salvation are a response to the Christian theological, anthropological view of human brokenness and redemption. So, theological anthropology, as you might surmise, is one of the fundamental theological moorings of the Christian experience. If our other theological interpretations of the spirit, of social engagement, of civic responsibility, even of views of abstinence, to name a few, represent the topographical mantle or crust of being Christian in the world, then by association, this issue of sexuality and the tradition of theological anthropology represent the bedrock below and often has the texture of granite. What is the human being before God? And what is allowed in the right ordering of its other human relationships? These fundamental questions are at the subterranean core of all discourse around sexuality in the life of the church today. The challenge may well prove to be a deal-breaker ecumenically, especially when one asks the second question. How may a human being seen out of order in these relationships also administrate the sacraments of the church? More than differences in biblical interpretation and exegesis, more than the freedom of a Christian to be both saint, say, and sinner in the world, more than the salvation lens or the soteriological lens available for all children of God, the fundamental mooring of theological anthropology is informing, explicitly or implicitly, this challenge of sexuality to ecumenical relationships today. As denominations in the United States, for instance, continue to struggle with the question of the sexuality of a human being, a constellation of ecumenical partners are paying attention, nationally and internationally. The Roman Catholic, Orthodox, and Pentecostal churches will disagree at the ground of differing interpretations of the human being, all the way back to Adam and Eve, unclothed in the garden. If we cannot find our way through this issue, this great challenge of human sexuality to the ecumenical movement, then we may find ourselves, having reached the end of the last question of the Reformation, at an impasse. It's difficult to say what will happen next. But if you stay tuned, as I will, we will discover both what the next generation of ecumenical challenges will be, and also the ways in which we will engage with our interreligious neighbors to address those challenges head-on in a radically pluralistic and globalizing world. I want to thank you for your attention, and I hope now that we can take some questions.